So I'm Courtney E. Martin, and I'm an author, speaker, and blogger. I blog at feministing.com, and I've written a couple of books, most recently, Do It Anyway, The New Generation of Activists. Today we are in Denver, Colorado, and we are at the National Women's Studies Association meeting.
Let's talk about your most recent book. It's called Do It Anyways, A New Generation of Activism.
Yes.
Okay, tell me about that. What was the inspiration for it, and what was your thought process as you put it together?
So the book is a collection of profiles of 8 activists. All of them are 35 and under, and they're doing diverse social justice work in the U.S. I was really interested in U.S.-based work. And it really grew out of my own disillusion, kind of coming out into the quote-unquote real world and feeling like, you know, I was this highly educated person who had been told my whole life, like, go out there and make a difference, you know, quote unquote, save the world. And then when I got out in the real world and went, wow, this is way more complicated than people led me to believe. You know, I think there's sort of a cruel ease to which people use that term, save the world. And actually, it's incredibly complex. It requires a lot of emotional stability and sustainability. And so I got very interested in sort of looking at my peers and saying, what are they doing that's really working and not working maybe, but like, how do they make decisions in a very daily way about the kind of social justice work they do? And then the other reason I wrote the book was I felt as if the mainstream media narrative about our generation, I'm 30 years old, so I sort of am in that Generation Y, millennials kind of lump. The media narrative on that generation is often, you know, they're apathetic, they're quiet, they're not interested in social action or political issues. And that was just so not my experience that I really wanted to be able to highlight some stories that gave a counter narrative.
Courtney, let's talk about your own journey a little bit. So you're 30, and you're very active in the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. Talk about what it is in your life that really led you down this path.
Interesting question. I think that, you know, it's hard to isolate one thing. I think there's were a lot of important pieces, starting with my family. I grew up in a very feminist family within a sort of larger atmosphere that was actually Colorado Springs, which is an hour away from where we are today, that was very conservative. It's kind of the home of evangelical Christianity. And, you know, my entire extended family is kind of more conservative leaning. Some of them are very religious. And so I just grew up my whole life with this real awareness of kind of post-partisan conversations and kind of looking at how the written word could be an activist act. And, you know, I was on the high school newspaper and we caused a lot of trouble. And so it really gave me this good sense that kind of one of my gifts, which is writing, that there was a need for exposing stories and kind of telling truth to power and some of those really feminist ideas. The other thing was my parents, I think, really taught me to trust my own outrage, which is something I think is really important to talk about because, you know, as I've gone along through life, I've had these moments where I really kind of looked around and said, I don't think this is okay. And even though the world was telling me, oh, it'll pass or you'll get over it or don't cause too much trouble, I was really able to stick to my idea, like, wait, I want to understand this. So my first book, Perfect Girls, Starving Daughters, really came out of this moment of being at college surrounded by these incredible women who are also really self-hating and thinking, this can't be okay with everyone. You know, I'm outraged and I want to say that out loud. And so I just think it's very rooted in kind of the way in which my parents taught me to trust my instincts and my outrage, and then this gift that I was given of really loving stories and loving to tell other stories, tell my own story kind of in a political way that have led me down this path.
Let's talk a little bit more about your parents. There's a whole bunch of parents who sort of quote unquote try to save their children, right, from doing something that's impractical, right, or doing, some would argue that writing and pursuing this as a full-time kind of passion would be impractical. What were your parents' backgrounds, and what do you think gave them the courage to believe in you and really push you in this direction?
Well, I wish they were here to answer that. My parents come from a very sort of middle class background. They both went to Colorado State University. Neither of them are particularly like intellectual or kind of seasoned on either. You know, there's such a sort of coastal intellectual culture, and my parents are definitely not of that culture. What my parents are is endlessly curious. So they're both like obsessed with going to the movies. They're both obsessed with reading. They love going to museums. They love traveling. So they're these really interesting people because they aren't a part of that conversation, but they're always interested in learning from it. And so I think that in some ways I feel in New York like this kind of intellectual refugee because I'm like not among the people I grew up with. My parents can't believe the opportunities I get, you know, neither can I. But at the same time, they're really curious and they're really really aware of what's going on in various ways. So I feel really lucky about that. In terms of the impractical piece, you know, I feel like it's one of those generational gifts where my parents were basically both socialized to think, well, you know, here's where gender comes in, right? My dad was socialized to think he needed to just get a steady job and provide for his family. My mom was socialized to think she should, you know, become maybe a secretary or a teacher and then find a good husband to support her. And so I was raised with a ton of security for that reason. You know, my dad became a lawyer and, you know, sort of did his thing to make sure that we could go to school and all that kind of stuff. My mom became a social worker, which, of course, is a very feminized profession. And but they both always said, follow your bliss, follow your bliss, follow your bliss. I think they're a little horrified at first that I was like, I'm going to be a writer. And then my older brother was like, I'm going to be a poet. I'll do you one more. So they've really had to walk their talk in terms of that conditioning. But I think both my brother and I are really practical. We come from middle class backgrounds. So we weren't like, I'm going to be a writer and, you know, sit at home all day and like hope the world comes to me. We've both really gone out there and hustled and done all kinds of different work to pay our bills while still honoring our creative spirit. So I think my parents, once they saw like, okay, they're really going to figure out how to do this in a practical way, they could kind of take a deep breath.
Okay, take a deep breath before this question. If you had to think back to your experience as an activist, as a writer, to everything you've experienced until this point in your life, and you had to distill it down to one most important lesson that you've learned on your journey, what would it be?
That's a tough one.
Right, it's kind of a big question.
I like it, though. Well, I think I will sort of cheat and rely on my favorite quotation, which is at the end of my, you know, it's my email signature, and it's, engrave this on your heart. There isn't anyone you couldn't love once you heard their story. That was by Mary Lou Kaunaki, who's this nun, and, you know, who's never written much, but I found this quotation, and it really just for me was like, you know, sort of the last puzzle piece fitting in. It was like this deeply satisfying thing to hear. And I think it's because, you know, I do think my calling is storytelling, and I do think it has a deeply political power, and that power is that it humanizes people. And I think all of the work that I do, everything that I'm passionate about comes down to humanizing one another and being able to tell stories that, you know, sort of shake us up and shift our perspective on being able to otherize certain people and therefore oppress them. So, you know, I just feel like the sort of potency of writing and of storytelling is at the center of my life and my work and sort of my orientation towards changing the world.
And the biggest obstacle that you faced, and how did you overcome that?
I think the biggest obstacle is within. I mean, and that's true for so many people, but I think because I'm, you know, deeply sensitive and empathic and really get invested in these stories, it means I also have the danger of being sort of overwhelmed by them and disillusioned. And, you know, I was mentioning that Do It Anyway came out of my own disillusion around 2004. I graduated undergraduate in 2002, and 2004, of course, was the, you know, Bush-Kerry election. And following that election and sort of following my first 2 years out in the real world, I felt really deeply just depressed about kind of the state of the world, my own capacity to do anything about it. And I think, you know, that is deeply connected to the sensitivity and kind of empathy that I bring to my writing. So it's both my biggest asset and my biggest obstacle, because it's just sometimes hard for me to keep doing the work and keep believing in it and keep my sort of resilience up.
On the theme of your next book, Do It Anyway, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said the biggest obstacles within. I think people will be surprised that even for you, who's relentless and keeps going at this, that you face that. But I see a lot of people who really talk themselves out of pursuing their passions because it might not work. What advice would you have to them? I mean, maybe it's the title of your book, but maybe at a practical level, what would you say to kind of get them to do it anyway?
Yeah, well, I think Do It Anyway, by the way, I stole from Mother Teresa, who has this beautiful poem that's actually inside of my book, sort of the epigraph. And, you know, it's what it sounds like. It's, you know, it'll never be enough, do it anyway. And for me, that idea and sort of the practical advice around it is just shifting our perspective from like, how can this be a perfect success, to how could this be a really good failure? I talk about in the end of the book that Cornel West said, of course it's a failure, but how good a failure is it? And for me, that just was so resonant, because much of the activism I observed through my incredible journey writing this book was in some ways failed activism, right? There were people's lives who weren't changed. There were systems that certainly weren't changed, even though the people that I was observing were deeply dedicated and very talented. But the fact is that they failed really well, right? They may not have changed the prison industrial complex, but they helped one kid get out of juvenile hall and get into some sort of passionate project, right? So that is, to me, a really, you know, you could see it as success or you could see it as a great failure, you know? And it's, for me, it's like, find the emotional and sort of psychological framing that helps you sustain the work and then just keep working at it. And I think, you know, really paying attention to this piece of self-awareness of like, where is your burnout level? How can you take care of yourself? I think self-care is often framed as this kind of like bourgeoisie notion. And in fact, as like Audre Lorde herself has said, that it's a radical act to take care of yourself. It's a political act because we can't keep doing the work unless we're really aware of where we're at and taking care of ourselves.
How do you do that?
It's a struggle, not always particularly well, but I am really committed to, you know, I have a morning meditation and prayer that I say, you know, I live a block away from Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and I'm like in the park almost every day because I know for me part of self-care is being in nature. I have a community of people that I really rely on, you know, the crew of women at Feministing who I can kind of call on when I'm struggling with things, and you know, other folks who do all kinds of different work that I'm deeply indebted to who are the people that I call when I need help. So I think it's a lot about kind of community, you know, embedding yourself in a community, but also about like taking those pauses, taking those breaks. I'm a massive fan of dance parties as self-care because I just think, you know, that flow moment when you're not intellectualizing, you're not self-conscious, you're just like out on a dance floor having fun. For me, that's very healing. So I try to look for those kinds of opportunities too.
And how do you navigate things like interpersonal relationships? This is one thing that I find everybody to be struggling with. They're doing their activism, they're trying to figure it out, and maybe they're trying to date too. How do you manage personal relationships, friendships, along with self-care and all of the incredible work that you're doing?
Right. It's huge. It's such a lot to handle, but it's such a richness, right? It's like a blessing to have so much wonderful, you know, relationships and work to do in one life. You know, it's really interesting for me. I've had two main partners as a, you know, an adult activist. And I think one of them was, I've shared values with both of these partners, but one of them was not very activist, not actually super involved. And it was a nice balance for us because he could sort of bring me back from an activist place and sort of get me to like sit on the couch and watch a movie and chill out. And so that was a really nice kind of balancing of energies. The partner I'm with now is an absolute activist, and we share both values and sort of lifestyle. And, you know, we're both traveling all the time and really out there and trying to change the world. And it's amazing because obviously we have these matched energies, but then it's also hard because it takes one of us to go like, all right, we need to chill out, you know? So I'm really aware of how great it is to share those projects, but how we also have to help each other kind of balance out and step away and do the self-care. And I think it's also a matter of, you know, I don't feel this big work-life split, which people often talk about. It's like my activism and my friends, it's all rolled up into one. So it's like if I'm hanging out with Samita here at the National Women's Studies Association Conference, this is an activist setting for me, and I'm doing my work, but I'm hanging out with one of my closest friends. So it's like everything's very rolled into each other, which helps me sustain it.
So if you had to offer another piece of advice about the balance piece to young women, what would that be?
I think I'd say first there is no balance, so don't hold yourself up to some kind of, you know, pristine idea of what it means to balance. But I think it would really be about pay attention to your joy. And I think, you know, that's both about doing things you're attracted to and doing things that really light you up, but it's also about letting go of people or activities or jobs that aren't good for you. And I think it's some of the hardest work we have to do is to really say, like, you know, this person, every time I spend time with them, makes me feel bad. Because we, you know, it's someone we feel indebted to or we've been friends with for a long time or whatever the case is. But I think some of the most courageous acts that one can do to sort of sustain a lifestyle of activism is to make sure you're not spending a bunch of energy and time with people or on, you know, certain kinds of activities that drain your energy. And so I think it's really important to just kind of be aware of that and then act on it.
Only two more questions. So the rhythm of change, I talked about doing a project mm-hmm. about that. What does that phrase mean to you and how does it apply to your life? I think you've alluded to it already quite a bit.
Yeah, but. I love it. I'd love to hear how you think about it. But the rhythm of change, well, I think life, it seems so seasonal to me. I mean, that's how I experience it, that I'll kind of go through these, like, you know, full force, you know, really a lot of adrenaline, very excited, lots of ideas, lots of producing, whether it's, you know, op-eds or talks or whatever. And then I really have to kind of pull back into myself almost like a little turtle and do some, like, reflecting and, you know, step away from the internet and step away from sort of being in the kind of public light. And so for me, there's just sort of this like waxing and waning that makes me think of what you're saying in terms of rhythm of change. And I don't think that reflection or solitary time isn't an activist act. I think it's actually, as we've been talking about with self-care, kind of what sustains me. But there is this different rhythm to those two kind of states of being. And I'd like to make even more space for the kind of retracting into my little shell space, because I think it's, you know, both financially and just in terms of mentality, sometimes hard to do that. But I really do believe in the importance of it.
So thinking about right now, your book is called Do It Anyway. It's a time we've just gone through a midterm election. We're here again at the National Women's Studies Association meeting. Why now? Why mm-hmm. do people need to read this book now? What do people need to be thinking about right now?
Well, I think, you know, as I've been saying, for this particular generation, there's just a lot of disillusion. And I think, you know, by very well-intentioned parents and educators, et cetera, that have been in our lives, we've been set up for failure in a certain regard, because we've been told, you know, go out and change the world, save the world, here are 10 tips to do it. And it just denies the complexity of the project. And so I really hope that people will read Do It Anyway and get this sense that this is incredibly nuanced and complex, and it's still worth doing, and that it's within this context of, you know, generations of change. I mean, being at the National Women's Studies Association meeting, it's like this project of feminist theory and feminist activism has been going on for centuries, and we have benefited so much from the work that was done decades ago. And just to think that the work you're doing now could benefit people decades from now. You may not see it as this perfect success, but it could, in fact, have a huge ripple effect and really change the way your kids or your grandkids, or if you're not having kids, just future generations experience the world. And so I guess I hope it's like the right now book, but in a very broad sort of historical framework, that it's always the time to be activist. It's just never the time to be sort of a perfectionist activist, because you can't possibly know the reach of the work you're doing.
And any words of hope you want to offer people as they're sort of disheartened? A lot of people are kind of disheartened about the outcome of the midterm election. Any hope about maybe the influence that feminism might have on going forward, or just?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, being an engaged citizen is a lifetime affair, right? We can't just at each election, or particularly when we have like charismatic figures in the election like 2008, that can't be the only moment that we get engaged. I mean, I think we have to kind of reimagine what it looks like to be an engaged citizen. And feminism offers a lot of inspiration for that reimagining. You know, it's like feminist activism is so centered around looking at our daily lives, our relationships, the personal as political ideas. So while the midterm election results may be a little bit depressing for those of us who are progressive, it's like there's so much other work to do. And there's so many other kind of fights and challenges to be engaged in. So I just hope we don't limit our citizenship to this like electoral. I want us to vote, obviously, and feel really committed to that. But I think there's so much more than that. And so if we get too focused on electoral politics, we miss all these other opportunities for civic engagement.
Anything you'd like to add? Anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
You are such a good interviewer. Like, I think these questions are so interesting. So yeah, I don't think I have anything to add, but I just want to thank you for such awesome questions.
Thank you. And for feministing.com, your official role is?
An editor. Yeah, I'm the editor. I also really am the one responsible for the book editing. So I get a lot of the review copies and do a lot of reviewing of books. So that's kind of one of my little specialties there.
Great. Okay, thank you so much.